always believed that everyone has a story and that everyone's story has value. I'm Joanna Pena Bickley, the host of Designed By, a new Designed By Us documentary series that recognizes the changemakers, imagineers, and inventors in esteemed science, technology, engineering, arts, math, and design. As I have traveled the globe and collaborated with some of the world's leading scientists, artists, and mathematicians, I know that daring to design the future today all begins with a vision and a narrative of a hopeful future. I invite you to join us on a journey of discovery, finding the voices and magic makers changing the very shape of our future. I couldn't be more excited about today's interview, because what a remarkable journey that Dr. Kate Stone has been on. When I first met her, I actually met you at the 3% conference. We were introduced by our mutual friend, the wonderful Cindy Gallup. And it was one of those chance meetings. I felt like I had made a forever connection, right? That you and I had something in common that just really defied, I think often, you know, as creators and people who are inventors, you know, there are so many categories that polarize us, whether it's political views or, you know, like what group you hang out with or where you went to school, all those things kind of evaporated. And just listening into your story and then realizing that, one, we were cut out of the same cloth, and two, we were going to work together in the future, some way, shape, or fashion. We were going to figure that out. I don't know about you, but that was like, I just walked away with such a heartwarming feeling. So I couldn't be more excited to introduce our Designed By listeners to you, because anybody who deals in the future, right, which is a very scary thing, by the way, to most people. It's a very scary thing to deal in the future, because it has to do with the unknown.
I love the unknown. I love the unknown. Yeah, it's my favorite place.
Yeah, I thrive in it too. I think that there's this ambiguity that I run to.
Yeah.
Because ambiguity for me, I look at it as like, ooh, this is a recipe for something fantastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think we're not brought up in a way to be comfortable with ambiguity. We're not comfortable with paradox. Everything has to be in this box or that box. And so I really like ambiguity, paradox, going into the unknown, shining a light on the unknown. It doesn't mean I'm not scared. It can mean I'm absolutely terrified. Terrified of the darkness, but curiosity and what I'm starting to call other Kate tends to pull me into those places. And this Kate, the one who's terrified, is not aware of where other Kate's taken her, and then she creeps off and then wakes me up, and then I'm suddenly like, oh no, what have you done now? And then I have to figure out how to deal with it. So, you know, whether that's in a room, in a business meeting, on a stage that she's pushed me out onto, or whether I suddenly open my eyes and she's hiked me for 2 days in deep into the Montana wilderness to 9,000 feet on a mountain on my own at the beginning of a big snowfall, and and I open my eyes and it's going dark and I'm scared of wolves, bears, mountain lions. That's what she does to me.
Well, let's start with where both Kates came from. I love to believe that we all come from unique places, but it's in those places that actually help form us. You are such a remarkable person. I'd love to understand, where did you come from?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying all of the kind things that you said, and I felt exactly the same upon meeting you too. So, and I'm so happy that we're doing this. When someone says, "Where do I come from?" I really struggle with answering that, because I tend to be quite literal about things, and so, you know, I don't know how far back I'm supposed to go when anyone asks me. You know, I went into an ad agency once in New York. And I was a little late, and I just sort of, you know, hustled and bustled in, and they said, oh, you know, where have you come from? Wondering maybe, you know, why I was a little late or where I'd come from. And I, my mind was like, well, the elevator. And then it was like, well, no, the lobby. And then it was like, oh no, it was Brooklyn, you know? And it's like, and it just went back and back and back and all through my life. And in this flashback, and I just stared at them and I just said, my mother's womb, that's where I came from. Because I never know which bit, right? So I was born in South Cheshire, which is a county in England. And so, you know, my first sort of decade was there. I lived in the countryside, lived in a house in, you know, at the end of a lane, with fields all around, and just explored things out and about, you know, getting up to mischief there. Then I got sent to a school in North Wales, which is kind of a very outdoorsy school. So, you know, often like wandering around Wales, climbing mountains, going in mines and caves and exploring things. But then my parents then also moved to the Middle East, to Oman in the Middle East. So for all of my school holidays, that's where I lived. So then I was living in Oman and was flying there, you know, at the holidays at, I don't know how old I was, you know, 12 or 13 or so. And so that would involve me like going out into the desert to see where my dad was working out in the middle of the desert there. I'd spend a couple of weeks out in the desert with him sometimes, meet some of the Bedouin out in the desert. I'd be sent off with truck drivers, or I'd find myself at, I don't know, 14-year-old, stood on a drilling platform in the middle of the Omani desert. I'm not really sure that sort of thing's allowed, but, you know, that's what I would do. And then after that, they moved to Brunei on the island of Borneo. So my late teens, we that's where we lived, in the jungle. There were monkeys playing in the garden, and that was, you know, that was a very, very different place. And then I went back to the UK for a year, and then I was lost. I was totally lost. I was so, so confused as a child. And, you know, the question that we ask, sorry, this is a long answer. The question that we ask children, which is, what do you want to do when we grow up, is a really, really cruel question to ask, because I think there's a great deal of people our age who still don't know what they want to be when they grow up. So as a parent, you're asking your child to answer a question for which you do not even know the answer yourself. And most people, you know, don't even know. And, you know, it was only a couple of days ago when in a conversation about this that I actually finally realized what I wanted to be when I grew up, what I didn't know, and what I want when I be what I want when I grow up is to be me, just to be me. And I didn't realize that at the time, that the goal is just to become yourself. So that just really made me struggle at school. I had no idea who I was. I was challenged in so many, you know, other ways, gender and those things made me even more confused. So I totally failed my high school. And I say my parents bought me a one-way ticket to Australia, which means, I mean, they bought me a round trip, but basically I didn't come back for 4 years. So I spent my early 20s working on farms in Australia and became a sheep herder. I ended up riding a motorbike out in the middle of the desert, rounding up sheep. I'd never ridden a motorbike in my life. That's one little lie that I had to tell to say that I could do it, because I just had to say yes to things. I don't know how to say no. That's one of my problems. Yeah, and then did 4 years of that, and then really started to realize, without a degree, without an education that would be a place for the passion that I had, which was electronics, be a place for me to gain a deeper understanding of that, I was forever going to be doing jobs where these people from the UK came over in their gap year, because that's how they speak, the ones on the gap year. They would come over and they would be my boss for the rest of my life, and I would always be the person who was never able to rise above that. So I went back to the UK determined to get a degree, and most universities didn't want to have me, but they wanted the money that came with the grant that I could apply for. So I managed to persuade one of the universities to let me in, which honestly wasn't that great a university. And at the end of the first year, and three others went to a better university to meet, Salford University. And they didn't want to have me because I had no high school qualifications, but I told them we were a package deal. So luckily they took all four of us and we transitioned to the second year of the degree. And I ended up getting a very, very, very high score in my degree. I got just below 80% of a degree average. It changed my life. And I was offered funded PhDs at University College London, King's College London, and Cambridge University. And I chose Cambridge. And so I moved to Cambridge and spent 15 years or so living there and did a PhD in physics in Cambridge. The journey of where I'm from goes on. So I moved to New York, spent a few years living in New York in the city. After that, moved upstate to Woodstock, spent a few years living there. And right now I'm in LA, and I've been in LA for about 6 months or so. Yeah, that's why I can't answer that question.
Well, actually you did. And I think it was one of the most beautiful answers that I could have ever thought of, which is we spend our whole lives trying to be ourselves, or at least a better version of ourselves, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or even at least trying to explore who it is that we are. Because that what's really interesting is often that question that parents ask, or anyone asks a child, right? What do you want to be when you grow up, has more to do with a trade or a career than it does with the humanity of who we want to be when we grow up.
Yeah. Yeah. But don't we want to aspire or have our children to have lives where what they do and who they are totally aligned? And so it should really be about an understanding of who you are and then finding where that resonates, I think, and then acknowledging that that can change all along the way. And I think we spend our lives with people trying to persuade us that we can't be who we feel we are in so many ways, you know, whatever that is, you know, whether who you are is a carpenter, whether who you are is, I don't know, you know, whatever it is, it can be aligned with what you do, as I imagine you feel too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's interesting to me that it really took me into, I kind of knew what I was as a child. I think I was an inventor, mm-hmm. although there wasn't a word for it. And there certainly weren't, there weren't women that looked like me or even little girls that looked like me in my neighborhood that wanted to play the way that I played.
Exactly.
Or identified with trying to solve problems. You know, I was never somebody who enjoyed playing with dolls. I was more interested in how the doll worked.
Yeah. And so there are all these experiences along that journey that the experiences themselves and what we see and what we feel is telling us that we can't be who we feel we are. And it's not necessarily always people. It's, you know, it's just exposure. The exposure that we have is, you know, almost like this sort of writing that's in front of us that's telling us we can't be those things when we don't have the exposure to those role models.
Absolutely. So when did you realize that, what part of the journey did you realize that you were this creator? Right. I was like, immediately went to inventor, right? Creator, you know, someone who brings great things to life, and that's your method of learning. At least that was what my interpretation is. Did I get that right?
How do you mean? Sorry.
Sure. How would you describe today your professional self in terms of, you know, I think of you as like you are simply a Renaissance woman. You are a entrepreneur. Yeah. An inventor, a designer, an engineer, a creator.
Yeah. It's really hard. And titles and labels immediately paint a picture that's not going to be right. Mm-hmm. You know, because, you know, although language is supposed to be a great communicator, it's often the biggest barrier between someone, between two people understanding something, because of because of the metadata they attribute to those words and the journeys that those people have been on and their association with those words. So I often don't use the word inventor because it conjures up that the person in the garage trying to build the perpetual motion machine that's never going to go anywhere. And I kind of don't, I just, you know, it's you know, it goes along with the word mad. And they're in the garage and, you know, and everyone's just tutting and shaking their heads. And so I just made up my own title, which I don't know if it works or not. So I call myself a creative scientist. So, you know, I'm a scientist who loves to understand how things work, often by pulling them apart and putting them back together, and then wondering where the bits that are left are supposed to go. That is usually how I understand things. And then the creative bit is this: I do feel like a creative. And to me, a creative is sort of, I don't know, looking at the more abstract side of things and then thinking about how that means that things fit together. The ability to see how something that's normally used for one thing can now be used to do something else. And that's kind of how the word creative, I guess, resonates with me. So someone who can understand things deeply and then figure out how to use those things to do something that other people didn't think that they could be, that could be used for. So that's kind of what I mean by a creative scientist. And that's the label I've given myself.
I love it. I love it. Creative scientist. So when did you know that you were, you know, I found there were several times that I'm always brought back to what I'm supposed to be doing, that I veer off and I get into maybe too deep a thing. It's like, no, go back to the source of where, you know, where you've always felt not just comfortable, but you have felt at your very best in learning. So as a creative scientist, at what points in your journey did you feel like you've had those ahas, like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing? Oh.
I don't think I'm fully there yet, you know, because I'm still on a journey to try to get to that point where, you know, where it's at a point where it no longer needs the energy that I need to put into it that's associated with struggle, where it starts to fly, you know, where it goes from being a lump of awkward looking metal rolling along the ground to becoming a plane. I don't yet feel that I'm flying, you know, So I don't feel that I'm there yet. You know, and it's only within 5 or so years that I've probably started calling myself a creative scientist. But everything about what I do, everything about who I am is exactly the same as what I did from my earliest memory as a child. Nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. And, you know, really what I'm trying to do, there is a paradox, right? You know, I think maybe we sort of mentioned paradox before. Like, for me, everything I do on the surface is about technology, engineering, science. But everything that I'm trying to achieve has nothing to do with any of those things at all. I want to put things together in a way that cause another human being to have their emotions triggered in some form or another. You know, whether it's wonder or whether they cry, whether they laugh, whether they smile, whether they learn something, you know, whether they're moved in some way. I want to put things together so that humans have these experiences that have nothing to do with technology on the surface. That's what I want to try and do. You know, when I started my own business, which was now, I don't know, 10 to 15 years ago, I left a company I was at that was the startup that I was one of the first few employees at. So it wasn't my startup, but I was like, you know, the third engineer or the fifth employee or something. And I worked there for 4 years. When I left, there's like 40 PhDs doing some very, very clever technology. They still are. And when I started my own business, I said to myself 15 years ago, I want to develop technology that my science friends laugh at, look down on and pour scorn on, because I wanted to be free of that sort of scientist or engineer's ego of doing stuff to impress people like me. I want to do stuff that people who are not necessarily like me, who are just, you know, ordinary human beings in my realm, but extraordinary in their realm, create these things that can trigger their emotions, and you know, and I think that's what I've tried to do since a child. You know, whether it was messing around with wires and buttons and switches and hiding them under the carpet and down the walls and with speakers and microphones and things, trying to set up weird stuff to trick my brother and sister and confuse them. It was never really about how clever something was. It was always about the experience that you can create, you know? And I think that's really got in my head that as I think about things, that I question what science is and I question what art is. And I love nature, and I love natural experiences. I love old fashioned things. And so what I got in my head was that science is an understanding of how nature works. It's a look on the inside of nature. It's a look on the inside of how that flower works. And art is an understanding of how nature makes us feel on, you know, on the emotional level. So art's really understanding how nature makes us feel. And so then in my head, if that's the case, then science plus art, when combined with a sprinkle of magic, equals nature. And so, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. I don't want to build something that looks clunky and like, you know, clunky like an iPhone or something. I want something that's just a magical experience that connects humans in some way without technology standing in the way. And I believe that is what is in our future. Our future will be a magical world where you can use your voice to cast a spell and something happens. You can touch something and it transforms into something else. Or it's just a walk in the forest by the river and it's got nothing in it at all. But I think in a world where technology becomes invisible and where everything we create is about experience and not about technology, I think what we'll end up in a future that actually looks really, really old fashioned. And so one of the things I say is I believe the future will look more like the past than the present. And I think we're only halfway there. And the magical world of Merlin is not in the past. It's in the future. That's what I believe.
I love that. I really love that. And I couldn't agree more. It's probably why I spent so much time in the world of studying things like biomimicry and right, the way that nature, right, has come to organize itself into these systems that have this elegant programming. To your point, I think to that analogy of the plant, right? That there is an elegant programming that's in it, that it is invisible to us. And yet what we see is a leaf or a rose petal. You know, what we see is a stream of water, but inside of that water, that stream of water, are these organizing principles and languages of you know, everything from velocity to you know, the core structures of what we call science. But there's still, and I think you touched on it, these parts that are magic.
Yeah.
Like parts that we still don't yet understand.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. Because, you know, I mean, ultimately, everything that we think that is physical is not even there. I mean, all there is the flow of energy. That's all. Ultimately, that's all there is, right? And anything else is just a manifestation of the sense of something existing in a way that's perceived by our senses, that creates the illusion of something existing, whether it's the sky, the color of the sky, the stars. Really, there's just a flow of energy, and we are all part of that too. And nature is far more intelligent than us, because nature is us. We are nature, and it's a greater part of us, of which we are only a subset. So it's way more powerful than us.
Well, one of my favorite creative scientist things that you have created was you rethought paper. Like, one of the most magical things that I remember us talking about was the way that you rethought touchable surfaces, particularly paper. Like we had talked about like smart papers, things like that, but I'd love to dive into what are two pieces of magic that you are really proud of today?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So what I've been working on for a long while, for a decade, is how to print conductive inks with regular printing presses, laminate on some graphics so it just looks like a normal piece of print, use a conventional PCB with a regular silicon chip on it, stick that on it somewhere that's hidden and you can't see it. And now you have a poster, a book, a hat, a wall that you can touch, and it knows where it's been touched. And it can then either play some sounds and trigger an audio experience, or it can connect via Bluetooth to your smartphone or to a smart home device like Echo. And so I've tried to create that in a way where it just looks like an ordinary thing, and that people can't see the wires and can't see the conventional technology, and so that what someone then has is just an experience. So in some ways, well, to do that, what I've had to do is build a platform around that. I've had to build a system to do that. So, a process for how to print that, finding the right inks, inventing how we attach a PCB to a piece of print that can connect electrically and mechanically at the same time, which is a difficult thing to do because they're two things that require two different things. So, solving that was a massive aha moment for me, and actually one of the best inventions, because it enabled me to do this. And then I've had to build software tools. So, because every time I tried to create something, one of the engineers, coders who worked for me, would have to get in the way and do the coding. And so what I did is I moved the engineers away from doing projects, creative projects, to building tools and building platforms. And so they build the tools so we can just drag and drop a sound onto something or touch something and then press another button and then it downloads from the cloud somewhere. So in a way, I'm most proud of the system that we built that can allow someone from art school to build the experiences that my team and I create. So I'm proud of what the engineers have done in building that platform. And then it's the magical things that can come from that, because it's so important that we build tools, because if we build tools, we can scale. And if we build tools, people who have more imagination than ourselves can use those tools to build things that we never even dreamt of. So in a way, it's not really the things, but it's the tools. But then, when the first talk I did at TED, I really wanted to make something that took people's minds a long way from the technology and to another place, so that from that they could imagine other things that it could do. So if I just create the obvious thing with what I have, I think people still see the technology. So I love music, and I love pretending I'm a DJ with a DJ app. I am not a DJ, although I tell my children that on paper I'm the best DJ in the world, because I'm the only DJ on paper in the world, but that's how I get away with that.
I love it.
So what I made is a piece of paper on some cardboard that you could touch it, and it had an image of some DJ decks. And my niece, who's an amazing singer-songwriter called B. Charlotte, she's from Scotland, she wrote some music and someone else remixed it. So I had these two tracks on these paper DJ decks. It was just an image of DJ decks printed on a piece of paper. But we'd hacked a way of having that Bluetooth through a chain of things through to an iPad. So I could stand on the TED stage, and I could touch the piece of paper, and I could scratch, mix, crossfade, and be a DJ and hear the sound come out in the whole auditorium. And I also make little soundboards, little cardboard things that I touch, and they trigger sounds like air horns and, sirens and stuff like that. So I had a lot of fun being on stage, DJing with my piece of paper. And that immediately inspired DJ Qbert to reach out to me, who's probably the best scratch DJ in the world. He reached out to me almost straight away after that talk coming out and asked me to do his album cover. So we printed 1,500 album covers that had in them paper thin DJ decks that you could do just that. So I'm pretty proud of that because, you know, we built a platform, then I made this crazy thing on stage, and then it became a real thing that could be, you know, in over 1,000 people's hands. So that was pretty cool.
That's amazing. That's amazing. One of the things I think about is that, you know, what an incredible experiment. You know, what was the motivation? What was the problem that you were solving when you first started out with this?
With that thing specifically, or just in general, what I was trying to do?
I think kind of in general of what you were trying to do.
Yeah. It was a combination of things. So at the previous company that I had worked at, what they were trying to do was print transistors using polymers. So printing plastic transistors, basically. And I worked on that and printed logic circuits and stuff. And it was great. And it gave me a lot of exposure to printing as a manufacturing process. Mm. And whilst we were mainly using inkjet printing, I took it upon myself to explore the world of print in general. And so I visited printing facilities. I visited factories that would print, you know, the whole year's supply for a continent of one particular candy bar, and they'd print that within a week. Printing presses that could run at hundreds of meters a minute, and seeing how they could lay down materials in a resolution of just a few microns, or say of 10 microns, of how they could put down materials of thicknesses of a few hundred nanometers, of how you could go into factories where they might be making cartons for toothpaste tubes, and they'd print these huge sheets of card, and then that would go onto these other machines that would cut it up, and then that would go down other machines that would fold it up. And so I got to visit all these different factories. I'd get to go into paper mills and see these huge rolls of like 10 mile long rolls of paper or something ridiculous like that, maybe even longer, I don't even know. Or seeing the machines that would be used to make the potato chip wrappers, where they would use thermal evaporation of aluminium or aluminum for Americans on maybe 3 meter wide sheets of plastic that were 20 microns thick, and they deposit 10 nanometers of aluminium at speeds of something like 60 to 80 kilometers an hour in this huge machine. It was phenomenal. Or they'd used plasma deposition processes. Anyway, so I'm going on about all of that, but I saw these processes used to make candy bar wrappers that from my degree in electronics and PhD in physics was all about studying how we make transistors, how we make integrated circuits. And I saw exactly the same processes being used to make these things. You know, thermal evaporation, plasma deposition, that's how we make transistors, that's how we make integrated circuits, right? Mm-hmm. And so it just fascinated me that there were these factories in every single city in the world that had the manufacturing capabilities that could do more than make a cardboard box. And so that's one thing that I got in my head. The other thing I got in my head was seeing what we can do with conductive ink and seeing how that can add touch to an object. And when I was doing this was before the iPhone came out. This was BlackBerry days, right? Mm-hmm. And I really started to think about how we could add touch to a surface that didn't appear to have touch, and that then that object could then do something. So how could I make an ordinary object somehow become sentient? And I think people misuse the word sentient in my mind when we look for sentient beings. I think all that means is that they can feel, and like everything can feel. We really mean sapient, I think, is the word we mean, which can think, right? I think we misuse that word. Why do people say that? Why do people say we're looking for sentient beings? Everything is sentient, a plant. So how could I make everyday objects somehow become sentient using the same processes that were already used to make them. And that's what I got in my head. Again, sorry, a long answer, but I'm like, given that the cardboard box is printed using the same processes that we use to make an iPhone, why can we not give that cardboard box some magical sense of knowing that it's been touched, and then that it has the ability to process that information, know what you want it to do, and then act on that thing and then do something, whether that's play you a sound and tell you a story from the master distiller that made the whiskey that's coming in that box, or whether you've touched the printed light switch that's on the wall and connects to Echo and turns the lights on and off. Or what I like to do is I put it on the brim of my baseball cap. So when I'm on stage and I touch the brim of my baseball cap, it triggers air horn sounds and everyone puts their hands on their ears because they hate the air horn sounds. But I love it and really am a big child inside and I like the mischief.
I love it. I love it. There's a million uses for it. And I love the fact that it was, you're taking this object and giving it sensory capabilities.
Yeah.
And I think this is long before, I think long before that we knew that we were even capable or should have something like that. Why wouldn't you touch a wall that knew it needed to be touched? It's almost humanizing it.
Yeah. And our parents tried to educate us out of this, right? Because our parents say, when we're a child, look with your eyes, not with your hands. We instinctively want to touch things, to explore them and know how they feel. Even when we write on something, do not touch. Have you ever been that person that when you read that thing that says wet paint, you kind of like, is it really wet though?
No, totally. Not only have I said it, I'm like, oh, I wonder what it would be like to draw my name there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And if it's red paint, you're literally caught red-handed.
Yes. And the same thing with concrete. It's like that, right?
Yeah. But we want to explore through touch. And like I said, this was before a lot of things. It was before, most social media. It was before iPhone. It just felt right to me. It just felt right that I should be able to touch an object and it knows it's touched and it can then do something. It just should. Just the same way we can now walk into a room and say something and something happens. That's what we need. It's combining that, and that's what will create a magical world. Like what I said, you can touch a thing and it will know what to do, and you can go in a room and cast a spell and then the room will do those things, which is exactly what is now happening, which is kind of crazy and awesome.
It is. I come to a place that I don't believe that we need more screens. I think we just need more human things.
Exactly. Right?
I always look at it as almost like, if I have the ability to enchant a thing that was no longer enchanted, which is the way I think when I look at what you have done over the course of your career as a creative scientist, it was almost like you took a magic wand and was like, I enchant you to feel.
Exactly.
I enchant you to give light.
Yeah.
These are things that I don't necessarily think that, if you came at it just for the technology, from the technology space, you wouldn't look at it that way. And that, to me, opens up the wonder.
Yeah, because like I said before, everything I'm doing has nothing to do with technology. And I think I wonder whether anything's really changed in terms of where we're going next. I wonder whether we're just driven by human behavior and humanity's need to be part of community. And I think we're just generally driven by that. I think we often predict the future by looking at technology and imagine where technology can go. We forget about the people and we forget to project where humans want to go, not where technology can go. Predicting the end of cinema and those types of things still exists, because while someone can have an awesome setup in their home, they still want to go to the cinema. I know that you can say it's just better technology in the cinema, but people just like being around other people when they watch a film. People like being in a theater, to have other people around. People would rather go and sit in the park and sunbathe and eat their food, surrounded by 1,000 people they're not even going to look at or speak to, as opposed to sitting in their own garden on their own. People are drawn to community and to feel part of something. And I think we should look at human behavior to understand our future rather than look at technology and where technology can go, because technology is always about being there to support people and build community. So instead of predicting, you know, the end of cinema, we really should have been predicting the rise of social media, because, you know, that's what happened. And I did, not that I could say that I could have predicted that, but looking back, I can see that, you know, we're drawn towards community, and we do not need it to be high tech. My favorite piece of technology, my favorite form of social media, although Clubhouse is actually competing a little bit, I'm going to have to admit that, is my ham radio. And the fact that, you know, when I was in Woodstock, every single morning at 8:35, I would get on the radio. I'd wait for this person called Paul, AC2UQ, and exactly 8:35 every single morning, the radio would crackle alive and he would say, "Is this frequency clear? Is this frequency clear? This is Paul AC2U coming to you from New Paltz, New York." and then he'd put the call out, and then one by one, people would join. And every day we all spoke for 1 to 3 minutes and told each other what we were doing one by one. Only one person can speak at a time on the radio, which is great. No one can interrupt. And so for that half hour, we spent 90% of it listening and only a small percentage of it talking. What we learned about that person was an incremental boring story given relative to the day before. But take that over 6 months, and I felt like I knew these people. I'd known them for life, and I'd never even seen them face to face. Didn't even know what they looked like. I just heard their voice over the radio. We're drawn to community. And I think that's why something like Clubhouse is taken off. Low tech, very low tech, but big on community, connection, belonging. And I think that's where we're going, not high tech. And I think that, you know, supports what I believe in terms of the future looking more like the past than the present. And I'll now breathe.
Yes, take a breath, because I think that's a fabulous. So, and it's interesting. I think that you're absolutely right. I was a kid. I didn't necessarily have, we didn't quite have the ham radios. It's a little bit, you know, I came to the next generation where, you know, the neighborhood kids could get on a frequency, right? We had antenna radios. And I remember actually building one myself.
Yeah.
Right. Because, you know, it was one of those things where my parents looked at me and was like, we got you dolls and that was all we could afford to get you.
But,
And I was like, but I actually want to talk with everybody else in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And not do it on a phone, which was also still available to me, but wasn't as magical.
No, exactly. No, and I only got into the ham radio in the last couple of years. But yeah, when I was a kid, I bought a kit off the back of a magazine and built a radio, an FM radio transmitter. And then I got my dad's favorite book, which was Captain Hornblower, and carved out the insides and hid the radio inside the transmitter inside the book, left it next to my parents, crept off to the bedroom, tuned in the radio and listened to what went on. And I can't get those. I can't get that out of my head now. It's be careful what you listen to.
So tell me about one of the things that maybe one of the creations that maybe you're the most proud of.
Well, I mean, so I spoke about what I did, you know, I spoke about what I did with the platform before and making the DJ techs before. But just, I don't know. I just think, I think it's just more along those lines. So I think, I really enjoyed something we did at South by Southwest. We built large walls, that when you took, we built a 50-foot wall in the street, and people could touch that wall in hundreds of places. It was like a mural, and it would play sounds, and then they could jam playing with that wall. And really just seeing people play with the walls that we built and seeing the smiles on their face and seeing, I love seeing someone tug someone's, I've forgotten the word, sleeve, a cuff on someone's sleeve and pull them over to something that I've built, because they want to show someone else that thing, and seeing that excitement that someone has, and seeing that kind of infectious excitement from something that you've built. So I'm pretty proud of doing that, you know, pretty proud of, again, creating things that trigger someone's emotions, where technology becomes invisible.
Absolutely. Talk to me about some of the trade-offs and the sacrifices that you had to do to get that to even come alive.
Oh,
because those are the hardest decisions to me as a creator, is when you're in that creation mode, bringing it to life, that you have to, you know, where do you trade off to make sure that it actually gets brought to market?
Yeah, I mean, it really comes down to the energy required to have an infinite amount of tenacity to be able to just keep on going when everything and everyone around you is telling you what you want to do will not work, that you can't do it. You're driven by curiosity, and a sense of a creative vision of something that you want to be realized, but everything around you was telling you can't do that. When the printers told me that it wasn't possible to print what I wanted to print on a printing machine, I used all the credit cards I had to buy a very, very large printing press that ran 100 meters a minute, and someone like me should not be owning, and certainly I had no clue how to use it. And I ended up mostly getting a lot of ink all over the floor and mopping it up at midnight with a mop bucket. It's you know, the sacrifice is the energy that you have to give to keep on going, doing something that, you know, I'm saying the same thing again, but just constant naysaying of this cannot be done. You know, you can't do that. You can't put capacitive touch onto that. These inks won't work with this chip. This chip isn't able to play these sounds. And it's like, don't tell me that. Don't tell me what can't be done. Tell me what compromise you can help me make so that I can still achieve the thing that I want to be done. Don't tell me it can't be done. Tell me you can't have it in this color, but I can do this. You can't have it in this size, but we can do this. And so it's just dealing with all of that negativity constantly, and not giving up. And that's something I've had in me for a long time, is this drive of never giving up. I get obsessed with things, and I won't ever give up. I will just keep on going. And it's doing that is hard, lonely, requires so much energy, can be heartbreaking. And, you know, there are many other ways I could spend my time and be more, you know, air quotes, successful than doing what I'm doing. But there's nothing more rewarding than doing what I'm doing. At the moment, I have a new obsession. At the moment, my new obsession is climbing a mountain every single day. And when I say a mountain, I am defining a mountain as anything over 1,000 feet elevation gain. So that's what I'm doing at the moment. And I've been doing it now for over a week, every single day. So I had to do it earlier on today. So I climbed my mountain earlier on today, top of Mount Hollywood. I don't climb, you know, I got to the top of the mountain, it instantly turned back. I don't climb the mountain to get to the top. I climb the mountain to enjoy the journey, and to know that I've had that accomplishment. But really, it's about always about that journey. It's every single moment in that journey. The anticipation of, am I going to get it to the top? Am I going to make it? How do I overcome the difficult moment when I want to give up? And the sheer joy it brings me as I'm on my way down, aided by gravity, rather than weighed down by negativity. Long answer again. Apologies.
No. It's, I think the answers are great, and because they're truthful. And one of the things that you've just really uncovered for me is that it is a mountain to climb. There's there's a metaphor in there, and the fact that you are conquering it physically, like the real mountain, in conjunction with that, actually is, I think, something really remarkable in a way that you connect those two things that, you know, you may not make it to the top the first time or the second time or even the third time, but you what you're doing is training your body to learn how to achieve.
Exactly. Yeah. Because, you know, I didn't think that I would be able to, you know, to be able to do that as I'm doing. Absolutely did not think I'd be able to do this every single day, you know, because I started out just walking along the flat, just walking along the street. I just started off this month because I've ate too much during COVID. So, you know, so I was trying to lose a little weight and get myself fit. And then I quite quickly realized that losing weight was not my goal. Getting healthy was my goal. Being hungry was not my goal. Eating healthily became my goal. I'm obsessed now with eating the right food, which I wasn't before. I'm vegan, and I actually realized that my diet was, I'm an unhealthy vegan. So I almost get enough of what I want by eating way too much. And so when I started to look at what I was eating, I had to change a lot what I eat to get that balance there, to have something that was very healthy. And that's been a mountain to climb. And yeah, my walks were only along the flat. But now I'm going up Mount Hollywood every single day. And now when I get to the top, I'm not exhausted. I'm looking at the next mountains over, and in a few days, I'm going to be climbing those mountains. And beyond that, I can see the next mountains. Mount Hollywood is only 1,000-foot height gain that I go on. The next one's going to be 2,000. And the one in the distance with the snow on top, it's called Mount Baldy. I wonder whether I can do that, because that's 6,000 feet elevation gain. I might die doing that, but but it's there. And I'm driven by that.
What is it that drives you, Kate?
I think it's a combination of curiosity, just absolute curiosity, and fear of regret. So the biggest fear in my life is regret. I do not want to find myself in a position where I'm no longer able to do something that I wanted to do at a previous point and didn't do it because I was scared of filling the blank, whatever it might be, you know, the rattlesnake, the bear, the ridicule, you know, the failure. There was a point in my life when just leaving the house and walking down the street was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. But the fear of being older and not having left the house as me, just because I was scared of what someone might say to me, the fear of being older and knowing I didn't do it and having that regret and knowing at that point that I can't do it, the fear of regret is greater than any other fear that I have. So it leads me to do anything. Anything, because there is no way I want to be older and not do the things and not have done the things when I was younger. So yeah, I'm driven by curiosity and fear of regret. Oh, that's a little deep.
That was really awesome, actually. Thank you. I think you've just answered what drives me. I hadn't figured that one out myself. I was like, I think she's right. Yeah, and it's interesting because so many people always ask me, what drives you to that ambiguity? What is that you are attracted to when it comes to the unknown? Mm-hmm. A part of it is the ability to master something. Also, to your point, is to conquer fear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We get one life, you know, and we're on a certain trajectory. Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I am scared of so many things. I am terrified of so many things that I do. But there's no way there's no way I'm not going to walk down that path, no matter what is in front of me, you know, whoever it is, whatever it is. Today I had to conjure up all my strength to walk past 8 4-foot rattlesnake. There have been days in the wilderness when I've had to walk past a bear, and it's like, there is no way I am going to turn back on this track and go home and say I didn't go on my journey because I was scared, because then I'm going to be at home and then I'm going to regret it. Although, you know, when I did end up in hospital, having come out of a coma because I'd been gored by a wild deer several years ago, I guess that was probably something that I should have turned back on. But hey, you do learn.
Well, the question is, should you have turned back on it? Or just been better identified what that deer was thinking?
Yeah, I mean, to be fully truthful, I was walking in darkness because I'm not normally not scared of the dark, and my friends were scared of the dark. I'd given my flashlights to my friends because they were scared of the dark. So I walked along this path in front with no lights on me. The deer was spooked in someone's garden, and it ran along a dark path straight into me. It never saw me. I never saw it. And so, yeah, I mean, had I seen it coming, I would clearly have gotten out of the way, but I didn't see it coming. I didn't know till I was laying on the floor.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's a dark place.
No. It's a good place. The interesting thing is that you're not afraid of the dark yet, you know, that is effectively that the non-fear, had an interesting result.
I mean, I am scared of the dark. That's the thing, you know. It's, you know, we know what courage is. You know, it's about doing things that we're fearful of, you know, even though we're fearful of them. So yeah, I am scared of the dark. There's all sorts of things in my head. You know, when I go out into the wilderness on my own, in the desert, in the mountains, wherever it, you know, is, I will go on my own. I will spend the night on my own. I am absolutely terrified, and I have the most vivid nightmares when I'm there, but there is no way I'm not going to do that. There's no way I'm going to get old and not have climbed that mountain or slept in that forest. There's just no way I'm not going to do it. I, you know, when I used to be in my home, too scared to leave, too scared to go out the door and walk down the street, what I got in my head was, I would rather die living than live dying. There's no way I'm going to spend my life hiding away, because I may as well be dead. And I'd rather go out the front door and have the first car knock me down than stay at home and be too scared to go out, because it's not a life.
And I think you're absolutely right. And I think there's so many people who don't overcome it, right? Who end up locked up within themselves out of fear of what people think, what people might say. What people might do, or what unknown things might hurt them.
Yeah. And guess what? Those things do happen. You know, I've walked down the street and have people hit me. I've walked down the street and have people shout things at me. I've been into a bar and been dragged out by my arms and legs and thrown on the street and then thrown in jail. Those things have happened to me. I have been in the wilderness and gored by a stag. I've been growled at by a bear, something with a fin, probably a dolphin, but I thought it was a shark, swam past me. Like those things do happen, but not very often. And there's a line in the Tao Te Ching that says, keep seeking approval and you will be chained. And there's no way I'm living my life in chains.
And that is the most, that is why I love you the most. I think that is, it's one of those, you have unchained creativity, you know, and you feel that in Spanish, I have the word desire drives me bananas in English. So I love the word in Spanish. My grandmother used to call it ganas, right? It translates roughly into the desire, right? Okay. Somebody who's got, or a better translation for her was, she's got the music on the inside.
Yeah. That's what I feel. I feel that in everything I create, because I imagine when I walk down the street, I can touch everything I touch triggers music and triggers loops and triggers sounds. That's what I imagine. And that's partly why I create the things that I create. Having said all of that, I really hope that, you know, people can hear that in there. I do these things even though I'm scared. I don't want anyone to think I can't do that because I'm scared. Believe me, I am absolutely terrified. I am terrified, but I'm just not going to go past it and not do it. I am terrified too, you know, and many of the things I do, I don't have the skills or the ability to do. I don't have the role models to do the things that I do. many of the things that I've done, you know, I would just believe that they were, it's hard to explain, but you know, that what I'm doing is just going to be totally ridiculed by society, and that someone like me can't do something like that. I definitely feel that too, all of those things, but we can't let those things hold us back ever. You know, we just get one life, right? And
yeah, we do.
Yeah,
we do. You know, we all have a journey. During yours, who are some of the people who sponsored some of your success or transformed the way that you looked at the world?
I always find that a difficult question to answer, because I end up just looking so much at the things around me and just following my thread. I don't look outwards very much at other people, which makes me seem really ignorant and self-centered, to be honest. My head is down looking at my feet, taking each step after the next. That's just tends to be where I am all of the time, just taking the next step. But when I properly think about that, there clearly are lots of role models, and you know, and those role models might not be people who are famous, mm-hmm. you know, who other people might know. They're just other people who I've seen being themselves, no matter what anybody thinks, you know, and being inspired by that. And I just think people that believe in me, people that believe in me and give me some of the resources to do the things that I do, you know, without that, I couldn't have done so much of what I've done. But honestly, the people that probably inspire me the most are my own family. So seeing what my sister does, you know, what she creates, seeing her work, seeing my children, and what they do and their journeys. I'm totally inspired by my children. I'm totally inspired by my niece. I mentioned the singer-songwriter earlier on. You know, at 14 years old, she picked up a guitar, didn't know how to play it. At 24, she's not put that guitar down. It's all she's done. When she was 16, she quit school, jumped on a plane with me and flew to the US, and we traveled around playing gigs in, you know, in different places for 2 weeks. I think a year later, she was on stage doing a panel with me at South by Southwest, both of us talking about music and technology, just seeing her journey of curiosity and not putting that thing down and not giving up despite, you know, potentially so much negativity. You know, seeing her journey, seeing my children's journey. So I think it's family, really, and that curiosity. And, you know, we tend to look at the younger generation as sort of being like the version of us that's not quite there yet, the version that needs to improve. The younger generation is version 2.0 of us. They are the improved version of us. I tell my daughters that, you know, you are Kate 2.0, like you're the better version of me. You're the next version of me that they came out with. Clearly, right? Otherwise, we wouldn't have evolved. We'd still be an amoeba. Our children are the improved version of us. And I think we should talk to them and treat them like that. And so they are my inspiration.
Thank you so much for joining me on this journey today. I invite you to join us on the next episode as we discover the voices and magic makers changing the very shape of our future by design.